good, thank you.
So we'll get started in about 3 minutes. While you're waiting, your quiz for today is, why did Rick put a picture of his living room and his dog Juno sleeping on the couch at the beginning of this session?
With the Kindle?
Yeah. Well, the Kindle, yeah, there's a Kindle. So their wife, my wife is right here.
Oh.
On the couch, taking the picture in our living room last, this morning.
Well, this morning.
So why just, you know, see if you can, this is the quiz.
See, what's the title of this?
Remember the class is climate change and clean energy, right? Or the climate emergency or the climate
crisis, right?
So think about, you got 4 minutes. 4 minutes to see if you can figure out the answer to this quiz.
What was the question?
Why did Rick put the picture of his living room this morning on a session about climate emergency? Why did Rick put this picture up here? Just, no. I won't do the Jeopardy music. You got 1 more minute to see if you can figure this out. I will give hints in a minute, but I want to see who kind of is tilted and will think about this. Is my mic on?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, good.
Is it too cold, too hot?
He's away.
No, Rick. The only thing, I mean, one, there's an electronic device on the couch.
Okay.
And also, you're looking at a bunch of furniture that's petroleum based.
Okay, there's a concept. Okay, well, I'll take other ideas. Why has Rick put this picture there?
Well, if your wife is wrapped up in a comforter, even though it's summer.
Okay, you're getting in the neighborhood.
The air conditioning is cranked up really, really high.
Well, remember, we live in Petaluma, California, just 15 miles from the coast.
But it's still...
It's colder than usual.
No, it's hotter than usual.
Okay, let's keep going.
It's hot.
And why is she on the couch in the living room?
Because she couldn't go to the bedroom or...
So basically, I'll answer the question. Why is this picture here? She texted me this morning, I had to sleep on the couch last night.
Climate change, yeah, it was way too hot in the bedroom.
Because in Petaluma, it got to 104 degrees yesterday.
Yeah.
Which maybe... once every 5 years. And at 10 o'clock at night, upstairs, even though we have the fog that comes in at night, so we don't have air conditioning. Nobody in Petaluma has air conditioning, or at least they don't right now. The fog comes in around 7, 8 o'clock, and the temperature drops. And that's why we get such great wine in Sonoma County, because we have the hot days and the cool nights, and grapes like that. It was 90 degrees at 10 o'clock last night. So she had to go downstairs. She said, I had to sleep on the couch last night in the living room. It was so hot.
Oh.
So you get the prize.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Yeah, no, I can sleep on the couch.
I'm sorry?
I can sleep on the couch.
You can sleep on the couch. And Juno also is sleeping on the couch because, you know.
There you are. Yes. Come over to you. Next to you. Okay.
Yeah. All right, let's get started. With the real stuff. All right, here we go. So today's session is going to be on clean energy. We're going to start talking about, well, how do we in some way address this emergency that we're faced with? How do we solve the problem in some way or shape or form? And one piece of it is getting rid of all those sources of energy that are emitting greenhouse gases, things that are warming the climate, substituting clean energy sources. But I do want to at least remind us of what we said yesterday. I'm going to probably put this slide up every time, right? The one thing we need more than hope is action. And clean energy is about action. It's about fundamentally changing the way in which we have energy. And energy is about everything, I mean, honestly, at this point, in terms of our society. Once we start to act Hope is everywhere. All right, another quiz. Oh, sorry. So anyway, today is clean energy. Don't call me alternative, all right? We're the good stuff. That other stuff's the alternative. All right. So, another quiz. This is a senator who said on the floor of the Senate, the Congress must begin to consider how we're going to slow or halt the warming trend and how we're going to cope with the changes that may already be inevitable. Who said it and when did they say it? Take a guess. If you don't know who, when do you think this senator
like
said
Muskie.
It?
Yesterday.
I'm sorry?
Nope. The Danforth?
Nope. One more. What year?
87.
Very close. 88.
88.
Tim Wirth from Colorado.
Wow.
Right? He said this in 1988. Oh, by the way, it was part of a hearing. You've heard of James Hansen, right? Where James Hansen basically worked, scientist at NASA, who basically said, and has been saying for the last 35 years, humans by burning fossil fuels and other activities have altered the global climate in a manner that will affect life on Earth for centuries to come. If Congress had acted aggressively then to address this warning, the climate emergency we face today may have been largely avoided, and the need for radical remaking of our way of making energy, transporting goods, producing food, managing buildings could have been accomplished at a much lower cost and with less disruption and loss of life if we had listened. But wait a minute, one more crazy thing I'm going to show you here. Even before James Hansen, I got to do a little. Last week, some archives were opened up and this is what they found. They found a memo. Oh, how come it's not up there? What do I have to do to get that up there? Oh, I know what I have to do. Sorry. See, that? It was so dramatic. I screwed it up. Hold on. Here we go. I screwed it up. Here we go. Boom. Executive Office of the President. A memo to President Jimmy Carter that said, fossil fuel combustion has increased at an exponential rate over the last 100 years. As a result, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is now 12% above the pre-industrial revolution level and may grow to 1.5 to 2.0 times that level within 60 years. Because of the, quote, greenhouse effect, so forth and so on. The potential effect on the environment of a climatic fluctuation of such rapidity could be catastrophic and calls for an impact assessment of unprecedented importance and difficulty. 1977. We knew. Time to act. So, clean energy, time to act. Let's talk about what we can do about clean energy. So, why didn't we act? One more, whatever. So, recent videos have been found. Greenpeace, in a sting, basically, found a lobbyist for ExxonMobil who described how he worked with shadow groups over many, many years to fight climate science. Science that, by the way, it's been absolutely clear in the files of Exxon, many other oil companies, they had scientists who absolutely knew the dangers. Mm-hmm. Okay? And they hid that science. Instead of bringing that science forward, they used that information, and more recently, to weaken President Biden's proposals to burn less oil. So this is not a, oh gosh, I wish we knew. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, talking about how oil companies, gas companies underreported methane leaks and all kinds of stuff. I do want to share one personal story. So this is a solar project that is one of about 9 sites at the Monterey Peninsula Unified School District that my company built. By the way, Monterey Peninsula School District, you don't know, is in an area that's really, really foggy. So people who worry about, is solar going to work in foggy areas? It does. The big problem is it's near the ocean, so there's a lot of salt in the air. Mm-hmm. So our maintenance efforts have to be to deal with the steel that gets corroded by the salt. But fog cuts down maybe by 10-15%. It's still a lot of production and saving this district a lot of money and obviously bringing emissions out of the air. But before we got to build the project, I was in discussions again with the leadership of the school district, and our model was: we do the design, we figure out the economics, we then put out an RFP, request for proposal, to all the various companies that could build the project, including Chevron Energy Services. This was back in 2011, I think, and then we evaluate on behalf of that school the economics, the quality, the financial wherewithal, etc., of the proposals, and then we provide that data to the district, and they decide which they want to work with, and then we're the manager of that installation on behalf of the district, because most schools don't have anybody who has expertise in solar, right? That's what they use us to do. But Chevron decided they didn't want to go through that process. They decided that they would go to the school board. They'd go around the administration. Anybody here work in schools? Yeah. How do you like it when the school board tells you how to do your job, right? Okay. They decided to go to the school board and try to pressure the administrators to just hire Chevron. And the superintendent, the superintendent I work with, said, "Rick, I gotta deal with this thing." I said, "Well, that's fine. Let's have them come forward and have a meeting to share why they think they should do it, why they should be the ones." Now, what I knew from past RFPs I had done for other school districts, that Chevron was on a pricing level 20 to 25% higher than any of the other vendors, right? And I knew that it was the same panels, they were going to use the same panels, same steel, same inverters. And so they came and they talked about, they did this big presentation. They had 5 people, you know, vice president of this and engineering that. And I went through their model and I said, "Well, here's our financial model. Here's what we think the pricing should be. You know, this is how we modeled it. Why is your pricing so much higher?" And then, "Well, we do this and we do that." And I was like, "Yeah, but that's what we have in the contract. All the vendors are going to have to do all those things that you say you're going to do." At the end, the guy said, "Well, look, the reason you should hire us is because we're Chevron." That was the reason they get paid 25% more than anybody else. Now, they actually, finally, they did this enough to not just my clients, but other schools. They got out of the business. They left the business. Why were they in that business? We had a conversation earlier about what?
Improving their image.
Improving their image. It's called greenwashing. Okay? So, anyway, I'm not a big fan of fossil fuel companies. I'll just be really clear. But let's talk about the good news. Another quiz. Today, the 4 major sources of electricity in the United States come from renewables. Coal, methane, which is the main component of natural gas, and nuclear. 4 main sources. 3 of these sources each contribute about 20%. The other one, 40%. Which 3 do you think contribute 20%? And which one, 40%?
3 of these.
Okay. Which one does 40%?
Coal.
Natural gas. Boom. Natural gas. And I don't call it natural gas anymore. I call it unnatural gas. It's methane. Natural is a marketing word. It has nothing to do with the science. Okay? It's a marketing tool. Natural. Doesn't it sound like natural cereal? Right? Natural milk. Oh, natural gas. That's great. Okay. So the other, coal used to be the big component, but look at the, coal is the yellow line. Look what's happened to coal in the last 20 years. Coal's now down to 19, actually this was 2021. It's less, although there's something going on right now around gas prices, right? Mm-hmm. Something's happening in Europe. I don't know.
Yes.
Demand for gas is from U.S. is going up because somebody's not providing gas supply? Okay. So coal is gone up a little bit, gas has gone down a little bit, but the point being, number two is now renewables. Anybody know that?
No.
The second largest source of electricity is now renewables. Awesome. Look where it was, just 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and the curve, obviously, is about the same as the natural gas curve. And we'll talk about what those dynamics are, because it's important to understand the clean energy revolution.
Rick?
Yeah.
Why are they called renewable? Coal isn't going to renew itself in our lifetime.
Coal's not renewable. Huh? Renewables include wind, solar.
Okay, I misread the previous slide then.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. That was one of the choices. It wasn't what those things were.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No.
That, I didn't. I think my English teacher. It's a problem. But the other news is in April 2021, actually, the Energy Information Administration, this is a U.S. agency, reported that renewables accounted for more than a quarter of all electrical generation in April 2021. That's the annual basis. In the spring, it's always more because there's more sun, you know, relative to usage and so forth. So, with solar and wind climbing, I gotta get my notes here straight. Come here. Where is that? I'll do it. Sorry. The other more recent fact is on April 3rd of this year, 97% of the electricity in California was solar and wind.
Wow.
And California is not the largest producer of renewable energy in the country. Who is?
Texas.
Very good.
Really?
Wind. That really hippy-dippy state that really is into, you know, clean energy, right? One of the things that's it's hard for people to understand, and it's always been a feat, the Energy Administration celebrated this fact, right, that 97% on that day. But this is the same Energy Administration, Information Administration, during the 2000s and through the mid-2010s, continuously issued reports and opined that alternative energy, what we now call clean energy, would never provide more than an insignificant amount to our overall energy mix. Even the notion that anything other than dirty fossil fueled energy is alternative energy has been a way these powers have tried to diminish or minimize the value of clean energy solutions. I make this point because one of the ways in which the powers that be have tried to block the clean energy revolution is to create this sort of image, this brand, opposite to the greenwashing, right? Throwing shade on clean energy as an option. And I experienced that personally in, you know, when I was running around California from 2005 to 2015, trying to get people to think about this alternative. People would, you know, school boards and various people would bring out quotes and reports from this energy administration, even under, you know, the Obama administration, saying how this is, you know, this is never going to be important, it's never going to happen, gas prices are going to come down, it's not going to be cost competitive, etc. But as that chart showed, you know, around 2015, they had to change their tune, right? Things really started changing here. Right? And part of that was, and part of it, we'll talk about why did coal drop off so precipitously? And we're in a period right now where it's a bit of a problem, but Here's an important, a quote I want to read to you from a futurist named Alex Stepan. The cost of change, even more, the cost of change, even more strongly incentivizes those who find themselves with outdated sunk-cost expertise to put their time and energy into defending their authority by policing the boundaries of professional practice. The lawyers, the accountants, the engineers, who built their careers around a mindset and a model, right? So the change, part of making the change happen is having to disrupt and undermine the values, the ways of thinking that all these professionals, journalists, right, have come to. Because to make that change would be to disrupt in a major way. And, you know, we as a culture, as a human being, as a species, we generally don't like disruption. So what they do is they call things unrealistic. It's not practical. It's not pragmatic. And that has been part of what we call, what Stepan calls, the instrument of predatory delay of making this change. So why has coal dropped so precipitously? On April 2nd, 2007, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, Massachusetts versus the EPA, ruled that heat trapping carbon dioxide is pollution. And the EPA has the power to curb global warming emissions. Okay? What that meant is that all of a sudden, there was a cost associated with burning coal. Because coal, despite all the efforts and all the money that's been put into trying to create clean coal, you've probably heard that term, it doesn't work. It's too costly. It's too expensive. And so, as the cost of burning that coal, because penalties that could be assessed against those power plants that burn coal, coal precipitously dropped off. Now, fast forward to this week. This week, somebody's nodding their head, the current Supreme Court is going to be ruling on a case involving the same issue, pretty much. Meaning the issue of, can an administrative entity like the EPA, does it have the right, legal right, to regulate something that hasn't been legislated by Congress? And many of us are very worried that they're going to rule against that, and then all of a sudden,
coal will go back up.
Right? Well, I'll tell you why coal won't go back up. But it hampers the ability to both regulate tailpipe emissions from cars, but also emissions from power plants. The coal industry is dead. It doesn't know it's dead, but it is dead for economic reasons at this point, because both renewables and natural gas are cheaper. So it doesn't make sense economically anymore. Not because of, by the way, not because of the added burden of cleaning up those emissions, but just on a basic economic technical basis. The cheapest power right now is renewables. You know, all that stuff 10 years ago I was fighting about, oh, renewables are so expensive, it's too expensive, we can't do it, it's too expensive. It's now the cheapest form of electricity. So coal can't compete, is the basic issue. Now we have this situation in Europe where they can't, you know, Russia's going to cut off their gas this week. And so a number of the European countries are going to refire their power plants. I mean, it's just, it's horrible. Okay, why did gas become, during this period, why did it grow so significantly? Fracking, new technology. People kind of generally know what fracking is. You press water into the ground, it cracks stuff such that gas and oil come out. And of course you have the problem of, you know, contaminating your aquifer. Oh, well, you know, we need the energy, right? But, unfortunately, you know, one of our heroes said all the above, right? Basically, his quote was, in his 2014 State of the Union address, he said, if extracted safely, gas is the bridge fuel, that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change. Wrong. Why? Why was he wrong? Did he know he was wrong? I don't know. But we'll talk about why he was wrong. As the fossil fuel industry, and more importantly, capital, right? Financial institutions who finance energy project development saw that coal was on its way out with their recognition that fracking was a viable way, at least initially. Turns out the projections about how much gas they were going to get out of these frack wells is way less than what the engineers told them. And so there's a lot of gas companies that have gone bankrupt and gone out of business because they can't pay back the money they borrowed. I mean, there are some people who think that with it, you know, with absent this current dislocation where gas prices have gone up, right, because of the international situation. In other words, we're sending a lot of our gas supply to Europe because they're being cut off, which means that the supply-demand imbalance in this country goes up, which means gas prices go up. Because of that, they're making money and still paying their bills. But when we, you know, within 3 to 5 years, hopefully that all goes away, right?
Excuse me.
More of these companies are going to go bankrupt.
I think your mic has changed. I don't think you're trying to...
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just your light's out. I don't know if you ran out of batteries.
Ran out of batteries. It's all about energy. It is. Oh, great. Can you hear me now? Okay. Anyway, I digress. So, a lot of money came pouring into fracking because there was this initial hope that they could make a lot of money doing it. They're turning out to be a little worried about that. In terms of, if you look at some of the very arcane risk analyses of financial institutions in terms of how much money they have invested in gas, there's a lot of nervous people out there. A lot of nervous people. Because these gas wells are not going to pay off, given what we're learning about the projection and production versus the actual. Again, natural gas. But why is gas a problem besides all those economic issues? So natural gas does emit 50 to 60% less carbon dioxide when combusted in new efficient natural gas power plants compared with emissions from a typical coal plant. Okay, so in that respect, Obama was right. Here's the problem. Gas leaks. One very catastrophic example was the Aliso Canyon storage facility in Southern California, where on October 23rd, hundreds of thousands of tons of methane were released. And here's the problem. While burning natural gas emits fewer carbon dioxide emissions, methane gas itself is 86 times stronger a greenhouse gas warming element than carbon dioxide. Now, it dissipates faster than carbon dioxide. It takes about 20 years for a methane molecule put into the atmosphere to dissipate. But every methane molecule in that atmosphere creates 86 times more warming than a carbon dioxide molecule. And all of course, the industry reports about how safely they are tapping and transporting gas turn out to not be true. The actual studies that have been done by real scientists show that gas leaks at the wellhead where the gas is being... Still got a problem? I'll talk louder until my assistant helps me out. Thank you, Matt. Gas leaks at the wellhead where you produce it. It leaks from the pipes that go to storage facilities. Clearly leaks from storage facilities. It leaks from the storage facilities through the distribution lines, and then it leaks in your home. And this is one little, if you take nothing away from this session, then the following thing. I want to ask you to listen very carefully. 6 months ago, I decided to get rid of my gas water heater and put an electric heat pump water heater. And there's the good news is my local energy provider, which we'll talk about a little bit, provides an incentive for putting in heat pumps. But in order to get the incentive, I have to... Can you hear me now?
Is that going through?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, man. In order to get that incentive, I had to have an inspector. Where's Don?
There you go.
Here you go. I had to have an inspector come to my house and not just inspect my gas lines, but inspect my furnace and my gas stove, which, you know, people can't get rid of their gas stoves, right? You can't cook without a gas stove. We'll talk about that later. He measured the output from my stove, from my gas furnace, and from my water heater. The water heater clearly leaked. That's why I'm getting rid of it. Turns out that my gas stove, even when turned off, emits methane at a level that if I was outside in Los Angeles, it would be higher than any level of emissions that I would be breathing in Los Angeles. Gas stoves leak, folks. Please, turn on your fan pretty much any time you're in the kitchen. Go ahead. Don't believe me. Get an inspector to come out and test your stove, your gas stove. They leak. Bad for your health, bad for the environment. It's still going on.
You know, Mark, I did check. They are getting the recording of this off the room mics.
Oh, they are.
Okay. But
I want people to hear.
Yeah, let me keep fussing with it.
Okay, thanks, man. So, gas leaks. And 86 times worse in terms of greenhouse gases. We need to get rid of gas. And, again, this was before Russia invaded Europe. But in the last couple years, gas prices are now continually going up. A big part of it having to do with the fact that we've put online these liquid natural gas terminals in this country. They were started being built about 5 years ago. They're now available to take the gas, put it in big tankers, send them to Asia, send them to Europe. Again, supply, demand, and balance. Supply is less, price goes up. We're not going to have $6 gas anymore. We're going to have, right now, it's about $18. Okay? So, in that earlier chart, you saw gas growing at the same rate as renewables because of it was cheaper than coal. That's no longer, that. It is cheaper than coal still, but definitely not cheaper than renewables anymore. So that's why you're hearing your utilities all of a sudden touting their new renewable energy projects. It's not because maybe they want to be environmentally conscious. I don't know. It's about the money. Okay. Everybody can still hear me?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right. You know what they call a solar spill? You know, gas leaks, oil spills. What do they call a split soil spill? A nice sunny day. I hadn't put that one in there. So what about renewables? And again, as I mentioned, I like to call it clean energy. Solar, wind, geothermal, and to a certain extent, hydro. Some hydro has some problems in terms of actual greenhouse gas emissions. And I don't want to go into the whole science around that. Small hydro, better than large hydro. Our hydro plant, we're good. We're good. The biggest critique of clean sources of energy is that they are unreliable due to their unpredictability and geographical limits. You can only put a wind farm where there's wind. You can only put solar where there's sun. We can't put solar in the valley here. I know people, Rick, let's get solar in Holden Village. Have you noticed how much sun we get a day? You know, it rises over the mountain. Okay. All right. Am I on again?
Yeah.
I am energized. And there are some concerns that these sources do have, you know, impacts on sensitive habitats, which is true. Or that there are better alternatives. Let's go nuclear. Right? But again, as I said, and you can't read this chart, but this is rooftop solar. This is utility scale solar right here. This is community solar. Again, these are the range of prices. Here's gas. Here's nuclear. Here's coal. So again, look at this side. And this was a few years ago. Renewables are by far the cheapest sources of energy, and they keep getting cheaper. When I started doing solar in 2006, and it turned out reliable. When I started doing solar in 2006, a solar panel cost about $6.50 per watt. Per watt is the sort of measure to think about. Today, I can get that same solar panel for 40 cents a watt.
Nice.
Think about that. Now again, it's all about supply and demand again, right? In 2006, there wasn't much supply, and because of things we'll talk about later, but particularly programs in Europe and the U.S. investment tax credit bill that was passed in 2005, and the California Solar Initiative that was passed in 2005-2006 that I mentioned yesterday, there was this huge demand that happened, and that's why the price was high. But with that demand, investments were made in solar factories. Where were those investments made? Who developed solar technology? The U.S., right? Westinghouse put solar panels on a satellite in 1954. That satellite is still operating. Those solar panels are still working. But as we've done in many other areas, we gave away our advantage. China invested in manufacturing. Huge investments in manufacturing of solar panels. And in manufacture of polysilicon, which is the element that goes into most solar panels. We won't go into the geopolitical issues there. It's really depressing. Okay, I'm going to give you a little discussion question in a second here, but I want to make sure that I've covered, you got the background here, I think you've got all the background that I wanted to share. And again, I hope you guys feel comfortable just asking questions along the way. I never said that, but let me just stop for a moment, because I've thrown out a lot of stuff. Questions, reactions?
What about nuclear? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Well, that we're going to do a little exercise on that. But the nuclear, so if you'd asked me this 5 years ago, I would have said, you know, we don't need nuclear, right? We've got, if we do what we need to do, and it's still true, around incentivizing the deployment of renewables, we won't need nuclear. And the problem with nuclear is it's expensive. It is expensive. And it's getting more expensive because of both the technology to make it safe requires more money, and it takes a really long time to deploy, to build those things. I mean, and so, but now we're in a crisis where we're not doing renewables fast enough, and we might need, and I'm coming to the position, we might need to keep some of the old nuclear plants that are cranking along. We might need to keep them going, even though there's a huge risk associated with that, because the bigger risk is the emissions, right? So that's kind of where, that's where I'm at the moment on that. Yeah.
What's the cost curve on home solar over the last 10 years? Is the cost for installation coming down?
It's a bit of a complicated question because it's very, local markets make a big difference. So it depends on what market you're in. But in general, it has come down. But the cost is less the issue than the value. Because policies regarding how much you get for generating your power vary from state to state and even within states, and those have been changing a lot lately. So unfortunately, it's a very geographic specific area. Yeah, another question.
Yeah, I got one data point for you. I built a 25 and a half kilowatt array in 2019 at my house. I've got an electric car.
On the roof or the ground?
On the ground.
Yeah.
And it costs about $1.15 per watt.
Yeah.
And my return on investment is 7 years, meaning after 7 years,
paid it off.
The cost to my car, to driving around, yeah, and the cost of my house is zero.
Yeah, that's my experience also. That's a good point. Most of the solar companies have figured out how to peg their pricing to a 7 to 10 year payback, depending on the local policies around what kind of credit you get for export. Because when you do it at home, right, you're offsetting power that you otherwise would use. That's saving you money. But there's going to be times when you're not using the power and you're giving it to the grid. And depending on the local policy, what you get for that power varies widely.
Yeah, let me add a little bit to that. Most people assume that means I've got batteries and then I'm off the grid. And right. No, you don't have to do that.
No.
I'm just pushing electricity one way or the other. It's either going into the grid or I'm taking it out.
Right. Now, I will say, though, that in places where the policies are going backwards, people are looking more and more at off-grid solutions because the economics are better. And frankly, the reliability is better. So there are some cases where we're going back to more of an off-grid kind of situation. It just really depends on your location, folks. That policy, I mean, the irony is, and we'll talk about it in another session, but a month ago, the governor of Florida, Rick DeSantis, right, not known as a particularly progressive guy, vetoed a bill that would have undermined the deployment of residential solar. The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, we'll see within the next few months, but it seems like he's in support of a bill that would do the exact opposite, that would make solar less viable in California. How do you explain that? That's a long story. We'll get to it later.
You know, we built a solar panel, a roof solar panel. Uh-huh. Electric company was resisting it,
yeah,
and we just had a battle.
Yeah. What state?
California.
West LA. Were you LADWP or Southern California Edison?
Southern California.
Southern California Edison. Yeah.
They were resistant.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a good reason.
Yeah.
I'll do a little digression. Just so, why do utilities, investor-owned utilities, want to resist?
Of course.
Well, what kind of income?
If you replace, uh-huh, the power with something solar from the house, then they don't sell you the power and
wrong.
The income.
Sorry, guys.
With them.
Wrong.
Okay.
Investor-owned utilities do not make money, quote unquote, selling you power. Most investor-owned utilities, the great majority, 90% plus, are under what's called a cost recovery regime, where they basically get their rates approved by the regulator, the PUC in most cases, Public Utilities Commission, based on what it costs them to buy wholesale, sell retail. They don't make money. Now they do make money with various accounting tricks that I won't go into. Where investor-owned utilities make money, in the vast majority of cases, is they are allowed to get a 10 to 11% guaranteed rate of return on all capital deployed. When you put solar on your roof, the need for substations, the need for transmission lines, the need for all the grid infrastructure goes down. That means they don't get a chance to put that capital to work to get that 10.5% guaranteed rate of return. That's why they resist. That's why they resist. Not because, now they use all kinds of smoke and mirrors to obfuscate that issue. But you talk to any energy finance expert, whatever, that is the deal. Okay? How would you like to get a guaranteed 10.5% rate of return on your capital deployed?
Yeah.
It's a nice deal. Why do you think people like investing in utility stocks? Guaranteed rate of return. That's socialism. I'm sorry. Socialism for utility companies.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I want to have this little exercise, but we have more questions also. So, in groups of four, two people for each question. One of you is a lawyer for Solar Project, and one of you is a lawyer for group wanting to protect an endangered species where that solar project is going, wanting to locate. How would you argue your case? Number two, two of the other people, one of you is a solar advocate, and one of you is a nuclear
advocate.
You've got $30 billion to spend in a climate crisis. Do you invest that $30 billion in nuclear or solar? You'll have 10 minutes. Make your case, argue your case, and we'll come back together. You guys can pick either one of those and argue with each other. Okay? That might give you less than 10 minutes.
Oh, I see. How would you argue with Kate? Not that you're like combating each other.
Oh.
Yeah, I thought she was like, I want this and I want that.
We can go back, yeah.
So, the first one is protected.
Well, of course, you know, I would argue that it was an endangered species. You know, pollution, you know, it's just horrible. We all know how you know, species are being eliminated every day, you know. And so that's due to global warming is a contributing factor. So that's kind of easy, you know. And the solar project, well, I would be, these guys are like, they're in concert, they want the same thing. The solar would be a solution.
Yeah,
that'd be a win-win. Yeah, those guys would be looking. I'm assuming that the first one they would be. They would be great partners. Team. As a group, they don't have any power. You know, they just allow us to make, you know, Congress.
I think there would be questions about the benefits for that. What's being
we have nuclear power plants.
Sure.
No, it's big. At the time where that bomb default in history.
Yeah,
that's so. Richfield, they didn't get any. I think they had Plan 6, they had 2 or 3 in the room.
There's two still standing, and I wonder if that was a picture you showed.
Or maybe. I could argue. You know, you got $30 billion to spend on climate. I'll give you guaranteed reliable power 365 days a year.
Do you have any ideas?
This whole global thing here is totally green. I can get you a great and guarantee it.
So there has to be combustion, right? What ignites the nuclear reactor? Do we also need electricity?
Nuclear is off of fission, so basically it's the same old archaic stuff as boiled water in terms of turbine. Nuclear just generates heat. So we can turn steam generators. There's a problem there. There's some dangers to it, but the French do it really well. They got 21 reactors in their foundation. United States builds reactors and engineering so poor that what the day shift puts up on that ship tears down. It's terrible. The management of our nuclear facilities, the last couple of Wilkes being one and all the other ones, and the one in Georgia that's like 6 times over budget or whatever it is, and the Georgia people are paying for it. It's shoddy. It's unspeakable how poor is that project management. I don't know, maybe just plan that thing, make money and let it fail at the same time. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not scared. Well, we had Three Mile Island, and Chernobyl, the big one was one on the brain. You know, I mean, that might have killed up to 36,000 people. I mean, if there is a leak or something, yeah, it's going to be But, you know, the fear of nuclear in the United States just increases the fossil fuel consumption.
Yeah.
You know, you solve one problem, you create one. But solar, oh shit, solar, solar panels are available. You can get them quick, they're easy to install, get them on the grid. But the nuclear takes a huge global company to put that project together, thousands of workers, maybe 10 years construction schedule, everything even going on time.
Oh, yeah.
Solar.
Take about one more minute, wrap up in one more minute.
Solar is simple. I don't know. I'd probably pick solar. But I'm not afraid of nuclear. Did you guys ever get out of kindergarten? Like Fukushima, you know? And, I mean, they built a thing that where the generators, if a tidal wave hit, they would get, you know, flooded.
I mean, just the ones in Washington.
Okay, let's finish up the last thoughts.
The seismic zones are pretty low.
Solar versus feces. What were some of the things that came up?
Oh, solar.
Yeah.
Oh. If you're going to have solar, you might want to store it. And right now, lithium is in short supply, and there's a huge deposit of lithium in the desert of Arizona where the endangered gecko lives. And the miner wants to go in there and just take it all and destroy the area.
So, yeah. See? Yeah.
What's that say?
Okay, so I'm not going to. We don't need to write it down. So that's one of the trade-offs, right? Yeah. Right. Now, there was also a desert. Anybody know what the Salt Sea is?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a huge lithium deposit that, you know, could actually revitalize that area. So there's an alternative to Arizona. You absolutely put it right there. Yeah.
Oh,
it's right there. What are the other things that came up? Yeah.
My argument for the solar project was we're all endangered species.
There you go. We're all endangered species. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
Oh, yeah, those guys are in concert. Okay. That's the way I saw it. Man, if they team up as a partnership and take over, you know, start taking on lobbyists or Congress, I mean, I got the impression they had the same, you're right, we're in date. They got the same motives.
Okay. What about solar and nukes versus nukes?
Small nuclear plants are probably less risky than the mega project we've known.
Right.
That technology.
That's a new technology. Small nuclear technology is evolving. Maybe less risk, faster deployment, maybe cheaper, but again.
And mobile.
And mobile.
Yeah.
Do you want them in your backyard? No, never. Just
kidding. Well, we're doing them in the villages in Alaska, right?
You know, this is an important question right now. I mean, actually, the Department of Energy office that makes loans to new technologies is going to be doing some investment in some pilot small nuclear projects. And that may be a solution. The problem is, as we talked about yesterday, we've got about 7 or 8 years to do a radical reduction in emissions. And I'm not sure if nuclear is going to get online fast enough. As opposed to solar and wind, which is, we've got the technology today. It's right here. It's just about production and deployment. Just about money. right, and will. So obviously I have a bias there. But here's one of the problems with nuclear, and again, this, it's not clear what the issue would be for small nuclear. I don't have data on that. But the big problem with nuclear is when they no longer are operating, the cost of decommissioning, isn't that a nice word? It's basically shutting down and cleaning up and taking care of stuff that could kill people for 1,000 years. That's what they mean by decommissioning. It's a nice, fancy word. Costs a lot of money. This is Diablo Canyon nuclear plant in Southern California, well, Central Coast of California. By the way, there's the San Andreas Fault. Just wondering why, what the thought was there. But it's planned to shut down in 2025 at a cost of $3.9 billion. Yeah.
Where are we at with the storage issues?
For
nuclear, but have, and also how does that,
we don't have a solution right now.
It's not different than it was 10 years ago.
No. The one that everybody wants to put it at is in Nevada, the Yucca Mountain. The Nevadans don't want it. So where do you put it? anyway, that's a problem. But I will tell you, the last 6 months, the governor of California is starting to float the idea of extending beyond 2025, the decommissioning, because of the worry around emissions and that we're not deploying solar and wind fast enough, and battery storage, which has to go with it. They're starting to socialize that idea. And so we'll see. We'll see that ends up. Yeah, two more comments, then I want to.
So my question is the battery technology going to come along fast enough to be the backstop behind you?
The battery technology, yeah. I will just tell you, as somebody, I did the first solar plus battery storage project at a school district in California in 2014. Those batteries crapped out on us in 5 years. They were Tesla batteries. But we negotiated a deal on behalf of the school district that Tesla had to replace them up to 15 years. So, there's the technology and then there's the contract, right? So they're getting new batteries, but we've done about 80 schools now with batteries. They're operating just fine. Now, the bigger question is, not just for behind the meter building batteries, but batteries to support large utility scale kinds of operations. The technology seems to be there. There's new technologies that are coming along. The classic lithium ion battery, right, that uses cobalt and nickel, which has environmental issues and social justice issues in terms of how and where it's mined. Again, trade-offs. That is increasingly battery technologies that use iron ore are coming along. I'm in a business with somebody who works for a company that's one of the major builders, what are called long duration flow batteries. So there's a number of technologies that are sort of on the cusp that will be here in the next 12 to 24 months that actually will do that. The big problem, as the gentleman here said, was right now the demand for batteries is so high, we have a lithium shortage, which is the main component of these batteries. We have a lithium shortage. So there's a whole effort in California to set up Lithium Valley with the Salton Sea to promote that extraction, and other parts of the country, Arizona, wherever, to get that supply chain up and running. 2 weeks ago, you may have heard that there was a whole kerfuffle around tariffs on solar panels, right? Mm-hmm, yeah. And Biden said, we're gonna suspend the tariffs on Chinese solar panels for a couple years because we need the supply. That same day, he also issued an executive order that will have the effect of putting money into accelerating the supply chain around batteries. So I can't tell you yes, it's going to happen, but there's a lot of effort being put to increase that supply chain. But again, let me leave you this number again. To get to net zero by 2035, which is the current Biden administration goal, we need, as fast as you saw those renewables going up, needs to be three times that fast over the next 7 to 8 years. We need to triple the deployment. The money's out there. The technology's available. In fact, from a production standpoint, we can get there. It's just a matter of building the plants. But it's a matter of will in terms of policy coming together to incentivize it. As of today, and we'll talk more if you're interested in the policy session, but I was reading this morning that it appears that Senator Schumer, the head of the Democrats in the Senate, and Joe Manchin, who's basically the vote that we have to get the number of votes to get anything passed out of the Senate, who happens to be from West Virginia, and who happens to own a lot of money in fossil fuels, had a lot of money invested in fossil fuels, they are very, very close to a deal. You know, he scotched the deal last fall. Very close to a deal that would provide a huge boost for solar and wind incentives, tax incentives, basically. Close to $500 billion, which is actually, that's a real number. It needs to be three times that, but it's still something that will juice things. So we will know about that as of August 1st when the Senate goes on recess. But the leak out of, you know, the noise, which you always have to take with a grain of salt, out of Washington as of today, is they're now down to wordsmithing the deal, which is very promising. But we need to get, I mean, this is the number you need to live with. We need to deploy this stuff three times as fast as we are to get to the net zero, to get to the point where some of the more disastrous consequences don't occur. Yeah?
How does solar play with the grid? I mean, you know, like in order for the grid to operate,
right,
we have to be operating basically in parallel,
right,
to whatever demand is.
Right.
You have to start building,
right, grids. And that's, yeah, and that's where we're not talking about solar as the only solution. It's got to be solar combined with wind, combined with batteries, combined with some hydro, combined with, I'm very bullish on geothermal, by the way, which hasn't been exploited as much. I happen to live in a county, Sonoma County, that has geysers, and we produce 60% of our power with geothermal. But there are other technologies that can make geothermal as a base load, right? Not an intermittent load like solar, to allow that balancing. But we will have a conversation one later on. What he's talking about is that sun rises, sun sets. The grid is like a bathtub. You can't have too, if you have too much water coming in and not enough water going out, the grid goes down. Opposite is true. If you have too much water going out and not enough water going in, the grid goes down. So you have to balance.
Mm-hmm.
And solar is intermittent, as is wind. So batteries are critical to manage that intermittency, keep the grid balanced. But the other key solution is what's called demand response, where people hook up their devices such that when the load or the usage needs to go down to balance things, or the usage needs to go up, your grid operator, your local distribution company, they'll pay you to connect your device, your electric hot water heater, your electric air conditioner, and I have my electric hot water heater, by the way, connected in this way, so that on days when they need more usage, they heat up my water when I'm not using it, which is good for me because then the water's hot in the evening when they have less power, right? They have less power, so they need less usage, but they've already heated my water, so my water's hot when I need it in the evening. Same thing will be happening with cars. Plug in your electric car, you give them permission, they use your battery when they need power, they use your battery when they need to store power, and they'll be taking thousands of devices and creating what are called virtual power plants due to that balancing. Right? Now I'm going to blow up everybody's head. The other way to do this is with data centers. Data centers use, as you know, our lives are tied to data centers and are going to be even more tied to data centers. Everything's about data, right? And data centers, some kinds of data centers, can very quickly go up and down in their usage and do that demand response. The one that's the easiest to do is Bitcoin mining. Bitcoin. That's why I told you I'm going to blow up your head. Don't shake your head. Tell you know about it. We have to have a talk. Bitcoin mining will become, you heard it here first, one of the most important balancing mechanisms for the grid. Anyway, that's a teaser. So we're not going to have that in this session. But if you're interested, you can talk to me.
You know, there's title stuff too, like
what?
Tidal differentials, like in Anchorage, we have the second highest tidal differential.
We actually have a system in Humboldt, near Humboldt County, California, that's looking at tidal waves, basically waves to move stuff. The big one's going to be offshore wind, more than tidal. Because offshore wind is less intermittent, right? It's pretty constant, right? As opposed to onshore wind, where you're getting the wind in the morning and the evening.
Yes.
But offshore wind is going to become really big. Again, the species issues is where that one gets difficult, right? Although now they're coming up with these floating platforms that, we won't go there. All right. Yes, we can. You know, choices matter. Tony Sieber, the guy I talked about, again, the same point I'm saying. We have the technology. If we pair it with market forces, that's our most realistic option for getting to net zero emissions. And if we make the right choices, we can significantly slow down the disruptions. Again, there are going to be disruptions. Things are going to get messy. Be prepared for that. Right? Think about ways in which you can personally make yourself more ruggedized in relation to the disruptions. Not just the weather, right? But the fact that power is going to go out more frequently. Right? This balancing issue and heat events like what we're experiencing. Places where there's high fire risk, transmission lines, you know. People need to think much more carefully about those risks as we go into the future. We can't, that's baked in. We're not going to change that. But we can have a livable society, I do believe, if we make the choices today and over the next few years that get us to that zero clean energy, or clean energy, zero emission future. So, yes, we can. And yes, we must. Okay? Anyway, this is what I just said. So where do we go from here? The most important, this is what I want to leave you with, the most important year to phase out fossil fuel infrastructure and invest in clean energy solutions is this year. We cannot put this off. And we'll be talking in the taking action session, if you're still here on Thursday, about ways that you can individually or in your community help make this happen. This afternoon, if you still have energy to sit in a room with me yammering away, we'll be talking about different business and market models to support this, that again, people can be involved in. So I appreciate your involvement. I appreciate your good listening, and hope to see you in another session. Have a good afternoon. All right, thank you.
That's at 1:30, right?
1:30.